Hi, my name is Saul and you are listening to The Story of London, the podcast dedicated to telling the history of the city in regular weekly chunks. Now, we've reached chapter 91, and last chapter I spent an awful lot of time talking about macroeconomics and also about the Crusades, and yeah, this one is going to be much more focused on events in London. So let's get into this episode, and it's going to cover the city's declining relationship with the king, serious internal political divisions being hinted at, new buildings being built and old buildings being expanded. It has one small earthquake, one gigantic flood, a couple of large storms, a few processions, and the sudden arrival in the Thames of an incredibly large sea creature. Welcome then to chapter 91 of the story, The Great Whale of London Town. We left affairs in London with the celebration of the firstborn son of the king, Henry III, in 1139. Well, we pick up the story in the same year soon after. See, Henry III was a Plantagenet king, which basically means he had a somewhat explosive temper. Now, maybe not as borderline sociopathic as, say, his uncle Richard I, but Henry, yeah, when he got something into his head, he'd go off on one. And as I mentioned last episode, he and London were about to start falling out with one another. And the first real notable big fallout takes place now, later in 1239. So, the story goes, according to the contemporary chronicler Matthew Paris, well, it all begins with, quote, a certain messenger of the king's, named William, who had been convicted of manifold crimes and had been condemned to death and was lying in close confinement, unquote. So, right, there's a guy called William, convicted of something. He's been sentenced to death, and decides that maybe he could either extend his life before his death sentence, or maybe get some mercy, by bringing what Paris called, quote, false accusations of treason, unquote. Now, apparently, this messenger accuses a whole bunch of nobles of planning to betray the king. However, as Paris goes on to explain, quote, amongst others he made a criminal accusation against Ralph Britton, a clergyman and canon of St. Paul's Church at London, who had been some time since a familiar friend of the king and even his treasurer. The king, on hearing this, ordered him by letters sent to the mayor of London to be seized and imprisoned in the Tower of London, and the mayor, obeying him rather than God, at once carried the king's orders into effect, unquote. Now that line, where it says he would rather obey the king rather than God, well, that refers to the fact that even if the accusation against Ralph Britton was true, Ralph Britton was a clergyman, and therefore should be judged under church law, not secular law. You didn't go around throwing churchmen into secular jails. At least not since Thomas Becket, you know what I mean? However, this mayor, a man called Nicholas Batt, sometimes he's called Gerald Batt in some documents, he clearly obeyed the king regardless of the consequences. And reading on, it says, quote, for he dragged the self Ralph with violence from his house in the neighbourhood of St. Paul's Church and imprisoned him in the tower, securing him with chains. Now, regardless of how you feel about it, that was quite a powerful reaction. This priest, this clergyman, was dragged out of his house over to the Tower of London with violence, as it said. And the church authorities of London were having kind of none of this. Quote, the Dean of London, Master de Lucy, when informed of this act, together with his fellow canons, pronounced a general sentence of excommunication against all the presumptuous perpetuators of this enormity, and place St. Paul's Church under an interdict, unquote. Yep. In response to this, the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral excommunicated everybody involved, which I would assume would be the men who laid hands on the priest and Nicholas Batt. And by placing St. Paul's under an interdict, he's saying there can be no more ceremonies taking place at St. Paul's Cathedral. So he threatened excommunication, and then he declared a strike. The Dean of St. Paul's of London was standing tall over this issue, but the king and his temper would not back down. And even though he had done wrong, well, quote, the king, however, although warned by the bishop, did not correct his faults, but continued with threats to heap evils on evils, on which the bishop was about to place the whole of the city of London, which was subject to him, under an interdict, unquote. So yeah, this escalates quickly, and the next thing you know, we've got a threat of an interdict on the whole of London. Now, I can't make out at this point, is it the Bishop of London about to put an interdict on the whole city for standing up to the king, or is this the whole city saying there will be no masses, no church services, because the king is kind of acting a bit of an idiot here? Hard to tell. However, even though the king and others, quote, were prepared to lay a heavy hand on the city, the king, although unwillingly, ordered the aforesaid Ralph to be released and to depart in peace, unquote. So, yeah, in this confrontation, the king blinked first. However, it still wasn't over. The king was still the king, so he did insist that even though Ralph Britton was allowed out of the Tower of London, quote, when he wished to add the condition that he should be kept so as to be ready to give an explanation when he, the king, chose to accuse him, unquote. So yes, he handed him back to the authorities, the church authorities of London, and said, well, you hold him then. But the church authorities were having none of that. Quote, the church replied that they would not, on any account, keep him in this manner like an imprisoned man, but that the church should receive him absolutely free, as when the king's attendants forcibly tore him from his house. In this manner, then, was Ralph released, unquote. Yeah, this is a bit of a prickly issue, and Ralph Britton himself prudently at this point, quote, withdrew after this chastening from the king's court, unquote. The whole affair came to an end when the Justiciar of England and the former Constable of Tower, a man called Stephen de Seagrave, he got involved and basically made sure that that man, William the Messenger, quote, who had, as above stated, culminated the nobles and the aforesaid Ralph, was ignominiously hung outside the city of London on that instrument of punishment called a gibbet. And when he saw his death was certain, he, although late, openly confessed before the people and his executioners that he had made the aforesaid false accusations only for the purposes of prolonging his life, unquote. Whew, matter solved. This messenger called William had made the whole thing up just to extend his life. And poor Ralph Britton was almost killed over this, and there was excommunications, and there was, yeah. This story illustrates how quickly things could escalate. A single false accusation can lead to the king willfully stepping on traditional rights belonging to London, and the city was just about ready to throw down at a moment's notice. And that Mayor Bat, was clearly someone who's willing to side with the king on such issues, which suggests that not all Londoners were being militant towards the king, which suggests battle lines are being drawn. Nicholas Batt was actually a huge part of the politics of London in this decade ahead, a great whale in the city's political stories over the next few years. And his story is far from over, and we are coming back to it this episode, but just moving on. As we were talking about St. Paul's, by 1240 it was back in the news, but this time for a much more glorious reason. St. Paul's Cathedral was finally rededicated. I mean, it wasn't finished yet. The building was still not 100% done, but in 1240, after about 150 years of building it, it was decided it should be celebrated and rededicated by the Bishop of London. To quote one source at the time, on St. Remus's Day, St. Paul's Church at London was dedicated by Roger, Bishop of the city, in the presence of the king and many of the bishops and nobles, who all partook of a festive banquet that day with the bishops and the canons, and to all those who came and devoutly prayed there, an indulgence was granted for 14 years, unquote. Ah, well, go to St. Paul's on the right day, you get forgiven for your sins for 14 years. Let's turn up. And there was room for them all, because let's face it, this cathedral, old St. Paul's, was massive. The building is said to be able to have held the entire population of London at the time. It was larger and much higher than the present cathedral, 596 feet long, 104 feet wide, stood over a site that covered 3 acres, and the top of the spire was 489 feet from the ground. I mean, that steeple, which I described being finished back in chapter 987, it would have, if it was still alive today, made it the tallest building in England all the way until the 20th century. This massive central tower was open at the base and the spire, and there was 2 bell towers on the west side. The nave itself had 12 bays, and the Lady Chapel was at the east end. Back in chapter 87, I mentioned that Church of St. Faith's, the local parish church for the northeast parish of St. Paul's. Well, St. Faith's is now located in the crypt below the cathedral's choir. It was an amazing build. 1240 also saw other church buildings completed. Over to the north of London in Smithfield, the nave of St. Bartholomew's the Great was completed. Down south of the river in Southwark, St. Mary Overies was rebuilt after the Great Fire down there, which we covered back in chapter 82. And to the west in the growing area around Fleet Street, the early English choir of Temple Church was completed. Church building was a big thing in 1240. It wasn't the only big thing where things were being built in the 1240s. Remember, the Tower of London was being expanded under the King's orders, and this was not popular with the Londoners. Not just because, you know, it's a big symbol of the King's power over the city, but also because, you know, they had to contribute towards paying it. And that's a bit of a slap to the face. Of course, if in 1240 Londoners were anything like Londoners are today, then we know that when the wall, the Western Wall, happened to collapse during construction, they would have laughed at that. Serves them right. However, the builders basically dealt with the collapsed Western Wall by rebuilding on top of it. And something else happened in the rebuilding of the Tower of London around now. The central building of the Tower of London was whitewashed sometime in 1240 or 1241. And this was how the central tower earned its nickname, the White Tower. As I've described previously, this rebuilding project by Henry III was designed to make things more comfortable for the somewhat paranoid king. And he wasn't living in the White Tower. His chambers were more in the what's now called the Wakefield Tower. But the Tower of London was still a dangerous place. And proof of that, well, in 1244, someone tried to escape from it. One of the Welsh rebels held by the king. And his attempt was, well, to quote an eyewitness account, quote, "Griffin, the eldest son of Llywelyn, the Prince of North Wales, was still detained captive in the Tower of London, and every day received from the king's treasurer 50 marks to supply him with food, according to his station. Though his wife had received permission to visit him, yet he was deeply affected by the tedious and unaccustomed long imprisonment, and meditated on how he could escape from the place of confinement. One night, then, having deceived his jailers, made a cord out of his sheets, tapestries, and tablecloths, he let himself down perpendicular by means of the same rope from the top of the tower. And when he had thus descended some distance, from the weight of his body the cord snapped, and he fell from a great height, for he was a big man and very corpulent. In this way, he broke his neck and died, and his pitiable corpse was found in the morning near the wall of the tower, and afforded a lamentable spectacle to all who saw it, as his head, together with his neck, was almost buried in his breast between his shoulders." Unquote. Ouch, that was nasty. The account goes on to say that when the king heard of it, he scolded and punished the guards for their negligence, and ordered that the son of said Griffin, who had been incarcerated with his father, should forthwith be more narrowly guarded. Still, back in 1240, London had other distractions. According to the Chronicles of Holinshed, in 1240, quote, 11 whales were cast on shore, and that one of these mighty fishes, coming into the Thames alive, was pursued by the fishers, unquote. Yep, there seems to have actually been a mass breaching of a pod of whales somewhere along the Thames estuary. And yes, as the account says, one survived and started going upriver. And with typical appreciation of the environment and of nature, the fishermen around the region had spotted the single specimen and decided to kill it. And eventually, well, the whale reached London. And to the excitement of all, it carried on, with reports saying the creature was so large it, quote, could scarcely pass through the arches of London Bridge, unquote. so it sounds like a full-grown adult whale. Of course, the residents would have immediately seen the whale pass under London Bridge, followed by a small fleet, as it was being, quote, pursued by sailors armed with ropes, slings and bows, unquote. And the whale was going upriver to try to get away from those who were trying to kill it. And according to the account, it put up a hell of a fight. Quote, at length, with darts and other such like weapons, they slew him before the king's manor at Mortlake, whither they had followed him, unquote. Mortlake. That's about 8 miles upriver, give or take, from the city. That whale had swum for his life. But, alas, his fate was sealed. Now, the killing of the whale in Mortlake in 1240 is often described as London seeing a whale and go, oh, look, nature, kill it. But from the description, it does sound like the whale had only arrived in London as it was being chased by guys from the coast. We'll just blame the guys from Essex and Kent and move on, shall we? That's usually the best way. We'll say, though, FYI, moving forward throughout the story of London, whenever you hear of a whale turning up in the Thames, yeah, it's going to die. Just spoilers. Yeah. 1241, however, saw a new order of monks arrive in London. We had seen the Dominicans, the Black Friars, turn up some years ago, and the Franciscans, the Grey Friars. Well, now it's time to meet the White Friars of London. The Carmelite order, called the White Friars because they wore white aprons, gained their original name by the fact that they were a bunch of hermit friars living around a monastery called Mount Carmel in the Middle East. Now, with the ongoing Crusades, they'd been driven from there, and this was noted by a crusader at the time, Richard, the Earl of Cornwall, brother of King Henry III. It was Richard who apparently invited these Carmelites to come to London, and they arrived on Christmas Day in 1240. By 1241, they had founded a new priory on the south side of Fleet Street, and this location is significant. This is a monastic order whose focus had been in the Holy Land, and south of Fleet Street was, of course, the headquarters of the Knights Templar. The site of the Carmelite Priory is today bounded by Temple, Whitefriars Street and Tudor Street, and was built in kind of a T-shaped on a east-west axis. As you walk to it from the street, there was a cemetery, and then beyond the actual priory, there was gardens leading down to stairs to the river. The White Friars clearly felt at home being so close to the Crusader Order of Templars. And oddly enough, they'd survive in this city much longer than the Templars ever would. But this is also one of the reasons why I keep going on about the story of the Crusades in the story of London. The passions that had driven Europeans all the way to Jerusalem, something we first started covering all the way back in chapter 55, are here and now in chapter 91 physically manifest in this city. It should be noted that in 1241, by the way, is the first time we have a clear, unambiguous reference to St. Paul's Cross. This is where the citizens of London would gather for sermons and public events, and also, well, just as a place for the folk moots. We know it's recorded in 1241 because they gathered here to agree to the departing of the king to go to Gascony to fight a war to defend his lands there. Yes, the king was going to Gascony, but yeah, we don't need to cover much on that. With the king out of the country, however, London had a much more serious issue to deal with. In 1242, the accounts state, quote, on the feast of St. Edmund in the same year, distinct thunder attended by lightning, a sad presage of the approach of a lengthened tempest, alarmed the hearts and ears of mortals. Nor was the warning false, for it was followed by continued unreasonable weather and by an unpleasant and disturbed state of the air, which continued for several days. Such deluges of rain fell that the River Thames, overflowing its usual bounds and its ancient banks, spread itself over the country towards Lambeth for 6 miles and took possession far and wide of the houses and fields in that part, unquote. By any way you look at it, the floods of November 1242 were massive, stretching 6 miles south of the river. That is immense region of land flooded. I mean, yeah, sure, that's Lambeth, but that would include the flood taking out today's Peckham, Brixton, Clapham, Streatham. 6 miles from Lambeth? That's waters reaching Crystal Palace, Hither Green. That's the flood reaching Lewisham, mate. That's one hell of a flood. It should be noted from courtly circles, their main concern was that north of the river, people had to ride to the Great Hall in Westminster on horseback now. Still, by the following year, the floods had obviously dried up, as the tower of the Church of St. Mary at Lambeth was completed then. Today, that church is part of Lambeth Palace, but back in 1243, it stood alone, facing the horse ferry route across the river. Now, you may remember, or maybe you don't, back in chapter one of the story, I mentioned how the bend between Lambeth, Vauxhall and Westminster was actually one of the easiest ways to cross the river. And this horse ferry that existed at this time was the only other route apart from London Bridge to cross the river. But obviously, because it alighted in Westminster, it was mostly used by court business. It should be noted that with the king away in Gascony, the officers of the state were running around trying to raise money for him. And there's a report of how this was really annoying everybody in London. Quote, about the same time, the citizens of London were aggrieved by a very heavy impost called a tallage. Under this form, the collectors and royal officers came to such and such a citizen, saying, you must lend such and such a sum of money to our lord the king, who is fighting in foreign parts for the interests of the kingdom, till he returns home. And according to the will and valuation of these extortions, the citizens were deprived of their money. But all these things, and more, the citizens would have freely borne, if they thought it would do good, either to the king or to the kingdom, unquote. Yep, this war was basically causing more tax increases. People were just convinced this was, a cause for being angry at the king. Of course, it was very easy to distract Londoners, at least temporarily. And on the evening of July 26, 1243, for example, they had a brilliant distraction. Quote, the night was most serene and the atmosphere very pure, so that the Milky Way appeared as plainly as it accustomed to do on the most placid night, the moon being 8 days old. And behold, stars were seen to fall from heaven, swiftly darting to and fro, but contrary to what usually happens, where little sparks shooting after the manner of stars, like lightning produced by thunder, but in one instant, 30 or 40 of them were seen to shoot about or fall, so that 2 or 3 at once would appear to fly in one train. Thus, if they were real stars, which no wise man could think, there would not have been one left in the heavens. Let astrologers declare what kind of thing they may portend, which appeared strange and miraculous to all beholders, unquote. That's one of my favourite moments from the description of Matthew Paris. It would have been a heck of a sight. Dozens, if not hundreds, of Londoners staring up at the July sky at this epic meteor shower. You can only imagine the reactions. As the year went on, the king returned from his war in France, not very successful, it must be said. And at his return, well, listening to the accounts, London had to drop everything just because the king was back. Quote, moreover, he caused to be proclaimed by the voice of a herald, by the means of the swiftest messengers, that 4 of the most important citizens or burgesses of each city or borough should come out to meet him, habited in rich garments and mounted on costly chargers. So, according to his order and edict, which was obligated to be obeyed, many were compelled to hasten from the most distant parts of the kingdom to meet him, not without great expense or trouble. And when he was approaching London, citizens in holiday garb, mounted on expensive horses and newly equipped, met him on the way in procession, each vying with the rest to be the first to meet the then king, whom they respectfully saluted and won over by their various and valuable gifts, unquote. It wasn't the only royal arrival in London that city had to cope with a few months later, during which Henry III saw to it that his queen's uncle, Boniface, was made the Archbishop of Canterbury. There was a formal visit to England by the queen's mum from Savoy. Quote, on the octaves of St. Martin's, as the said countess was then to arrive in London, the king ordered that the city of London should be decorated with hangings, curtains, and diverse other ornaments from the bridge to Westminster, and that they should put out of sight of those who pass through the city blocks of wood, mud, dirt, and all obstacles, unquote. Yep, Queen Mum's turning up, clean the place up, move the crap out of the way, put up some bunting. By 1245, the politics of London after the mayoral term of Nicholas Batt were incredibly complex. We know that one of the successor mayors had been a man called Ralph Ashley, who was a mercer, aka a merchant of some kind. And as I explained away last chapter in perhaps too much detail, Mercers in London represented the fading import exporters of the city who'd been suffering at the hands of foreign merchants, and under this narrative, the drapers of London were those who were buying foreign cloth from these foreigners and growing in wealth, and they represented an opposing faction. Yes, this is a simplification. But we're wondering if Nicholas Batt was a draper and somebody like Ralph Ashley was a mercer, and if the drapers and the mercers' politics was reflected in support for or against the king. I mean, we're going to see more and more examples of how problematic things were going to get between London and the king. The Liber de Antiquis says for 1243 that, quote, "At this time, his lordship the king took the city into his hand, that is to say, on the morrow of Holy Trinity, and redelivered it to Ralph Ashley, mayor of London, to be held in his keeping until his return from Scotland," unquote. So basically, there was a legal falling out between the king and London, and the king suspended the liberties of London and then said he took over direct control of the city. He then allowed the mayor run the place only in his name until he returned from Scotland. And he returns from Scotland in 1244, quote, "His lordship the king returned from Scotland to London on the vigil of St. Michael, and again took the city into his hands for the aforesaid case, forbidding sheriffs to do any of their duties. And then he entrusted the city then to the mayor," unquote. Now, it should be noticed, by the way, the two sheriffs who he's forbidding do suggest there's a bit of a backstory here, because one was Ralph of Bow, one of the old English spice dealers, but the other was Nicholas Batt. Yes, the former mayor, Nicholas Batt. He is the sheriff. And there's a whole problematic thing about London not being allowed to do, the sheriff not being allowed to do their duties until, well, how did London get its liberties back? Quote, "The citizens made fine to the king in the sum of £1,000, unquote. Yeah, this sounds like a shakedown. Politics in London, we can only guess at this point. We do know there was a new bishop of London, a man called Fulke Bassett, and that eventually a man called Michael Tovey would become mayor. And around about 1244, the bishop will sell a submanor, a large house with a moat around it down in Finchley, to the mayor, who would hold it for a few more years before he sold it to another mayor. But there's way more ahead about the story of Michael Tovey and that sheriff Nicholas Batt, which we'll cover later. But be warned, there is some serious politics ahead. Meanwhile, the king's passion for St. Edward the Confessor reached kind of, but not quite, its zenith. We know in 1242 he paid for a goldsmith to adore the new shrine for Edward the Confessor. But it was around about now that he decided that he was going to pay the ultimate tribute to Edward the Confessor. He would pay the ultimate tribute to Edward the Confessor by replacing the building that Edward the Confessor had spent so damn long building in the first place. Henry III ordered the entire rebuilding of Westminster Abbey, and it's been calculated that he spent some £50,000 on it over the next 30 years. The River Thames saw building materials shipped in from hundreds of boats from Kent and Normandy. Tin came from Cornwall, lead came from Derbyshire, pure brick marble was coming in from Dorset. In about 9 years' time, around about 1253, we're going to see records of 391 full-time workers being employed in rebuilding the abbey. But Henry III was not to see it completed. In fact, the rebuilding of Westminster Abbey was to take so long that in 11 kings' time, the nave would still not be finished. Over in London, that water viaduct system to bring fresh water into the city, which was started in 1236, finally reached Cheapside, and it was around 1245 that what became known as the Great Conduit began. This stood in the middle of the road to the far east of the street, opposite where Mercer's Hall would stand eventually, just before where Poultry begins. Like any capital project in London, funds were always an issue, it seems, because the conduit was not to be completed also for at least another 50 years. And in 1246, halfway between London and Westminster, along that long road which we today call the Strand, there was a change in ownership of a large property there. Way back in 1189, the then Earl of Leicester built a sumptuous house by the river. But on the 12th of February, 1246, the king granted this house to Peter, the Earl of Richmond. Now, Earl Peter was someone special. He was one of the Queen's many uncles, and given this lovely new property by his nephew-in-law. Earl Peter basically tore it down and rebuilt something much grander in its place. Please note, In about 17 years' time, Earl Peter of Richmond was to be made the Count of Savoy, and this house was named after him. It was the House of Savoy. In time, he would die. The house became the possession of an abbey in the Savoy region, but about in around 1270 or so, the Savoy would be rebought by his niece, the Queen, and she'd give it to her youngest son, the Earl of Leicester. It's, of course, today known as the Savoy Hotel, but the Savoy building was to play some important parts in the story of London going forward. A great whale of a building beside the river, partway between London and Westminster. And regardless of changing economic conditions facing London, river trade was always crucial. Just to remind you, we know the city still had two major docks, Queenhithe, upstream from London Bridge, and Billingsgate, downstream. In round about this era, as trading boats grew and the arches beneath London Bridge became smaller with the buttressing of the piers, Billingsgate took more and more traffic, especially off the fish and coal trade. Around 1246, we know the city leased Billingsgate from the Crown. Specifically, it was in the possession of the Earl of Cornwall for about £50 per annum. London is just carrying on, a city of spectacle and pageantry. And there's a lovely insight to non-royal pageant displays in the city when a bunch of the Knights Hospital are made a formal procession through its streets. And we get a lovely way to visualise what these processions look like in a contemporary description of this, which said the Knights, quote, having made all their arrangements, set out from their house at Clerkenwell in London and proceeded in good order with about 30 shields uncovered, with spears raised and preceded by their banner, through the midst of the city towards the bridge, that they might obtain the blessings of the spectators, and bowing their heads and with cowls lowered, commended themselves to the prayers of all, unquote. Again, the idea that the crusade was physically manifest in the streets of London. However, around all of this, there are ongoing political issues. As we've discussed already, Henry III and London seemed ready to kick off at a moment's notice, often over legal issues. But we can pick up on deeper internal issues within the city from the sources. At the start of this episode, I mentioned that incident where the Canon of St. Paul's was thrown into chains in the Tower of London by the then Mayor Nicholas Batt. And said Mayor Batt had become then later the Sheriff of London, one of the Crown's tax collectors, a few years later. Batt was clearly a man who would do exactly what the king wanted. The king liked this. And this made him unpopular with some Londoners, however. So just to recap, in 1239, Nicholas Batt had been mayor. And then in 1243, he becomes Sheriff of London. In both times, there had been contention between the city and the king. However, in 1244, he was chosen to be sheriff again. And the records say, quote, certain of the populace elected Nicholas Batt, unquote. So immediately we can see there's some kind of conflict. Notice it says certain of the populace, which indicates not all of them, a faction within London. And others in London did not like this, quote, saying that their said Nicholas ought not to be chosen for two consecutive years, unquote. Now the other sheriff at the time was a goldsmith, a profession which seems to have been aligned to the old Mercers faction, and it was a man called Adam de Bentilly. But no one seems to have an issue with him being sheriff, just Nicholas Batt, just the king's yes man. And if you want to know how big an issue it was, well, Batt's appointment is said to have led to, quote, nearly all the aldermen leaving the Guildhall, unquote. Now that makes us ask the question, you know, are they leaving the Guildhall in protest? Did they storm out? Were they ordered out? Does leaving the Guildhall mean they left in disgust at that meeting but carried on? Or did they leave and not attend to their duties or turn up to any more meetings? We don't know, but clearly the issue is a contentious one. And there is continuing tension in the city throughout 1244 and 1245 during the term of Mayor Ashley, which we mentioned earlier. Later, quote, this year, Michael Tovey was elected mayor, unquote, in and around the 28th of February. But this decision, this new mayor, was not ratified by the king, as, quote, his lordship the king was at this time in Wales. He was not immediately presented, unquote. The king finally returned from Wales around November 13th, and the new mayor, Michael Tovey, went out to meet him at the royal court at Woodstock. But, quote, the king declined to admit him in the absence of his brother, Earl Richard, and named as a day for the citizens, the 13th day after the aforesaid day, at Windsor, unquote. So, straight away, the new mayor, Michael Tovey, is turning up to present himself, and the king will not see him. Not without his more militant brother being there. We can tell instantly something's up, but we don't know what. And all that happened was he asked him to present himself 13 days from now at Windsor Castle. So along comes November 26, and there, quote, the citizens and the before-named Michael came to the place aforesaid, bringing with them their charters as to their liberties and the mayoralty, which being read before his lordship the king, unquote. So while not explicitly said, the fact that London and its citizens and its mayor are turning up and then explaining the city's charters and liberties and rights does suggest that what was going down here was Nicholas Batt was the king's chosen man to be sheriff again, and London was trying to point out that they should choose their sheriffs and that no one should hold the post for more than a year. And they had documents to prove this, Your Majesty. Is this why the king had wanted to wait until his tougher and more warrior-like younger brother was present to give him some courage to hear this? It suggests an underlying tension in the room. Now, the immediate response of King Henry III was to ask for time to have a think about it, as, quote, the king again named a day for the citizens of London upon his arrival there, unquote. Henry III asked for 2 weeks and change to muse upon the matter, and he arrived in London on December the 13th, whereupon, quote, he summoned all the aldermen of the city to appear before him on the morrow at Westminster, unquote. So the next day, all of the aldermen and important people of London travelled down the road to Westminster. And when they got there, quote, all of whom, Michael Tovey, Nicholas Batt, Thomas de Derimi, Ralph Serling, and John de Cordes excepted, were sworn before his lordship the king and examined as to the election of Nicholas Batt, unquote. Bingo, this is the issue. It beats around the bush, but here and now we can see it. The king wanted Nicholas Batt to remain as sheriff, it seems, and he summons everyone, but then asks the mayor Tovey and Nicholas Batt to stay out of the room. He wants London's aldermen's opinions on the matter. He clearly wants them to agree that Batt can remain, and he clearly seems to be indicating that those names he mentioned are people who are influencing the aldermen. Just sit down with them and they'll tell us the truth. The aldermen, however, were very clear on an opinion, and they said, quote, that they opposed such an election upon the day that it was made, because no person ought to be sheriff 2 consecutive years, according to the statute of the city and the oaths of the aldermen, unquote. The king was thwarted and decided, quote, the said Nicholas was deposed from the chivalry on the morrow of St. Lucy, and his lordship the king appointed John de Guisors in his stead, unquote. So with these details, we can imagine there's a lot more fraught relations going on, with the whole episode taking 3 meetings for the king to get to this resolution. And while the king conceded that, yes, okay, Nicholas Batt should not be sheriff again, he is clearly making his choice as to who the replacement should be, this man called John de Guisors. Is the matter now solved? No, because on January the 13th, 1246, the story took a new twist. Because, quote, after this, however, the said John was made mayor on the second day of the feast of St. Hilary, and on the same day was presented to the king at Westminster and admitted, for his lordship the king would not admit said Michael Tovey to the mayoralty, unquote. So yeah, the king refused, after the whole Nicholas Batt thing, to recognise Michael Tovey as mayor. Now maybe it's because Tovey had led the objections to Nicholas Batt. Or maybe it's because he led the delegation which had lectured the king back in Windsor. Whatever the case, Tovey was out. Quote, whereupon he resigned the mayoralty and John de Guisors was made mayor. Afterwards, on the feast of St. Vincent, the citizens, because they had only one sheriff, elected Robert de Cornhill, and he remained sheriff. Unquote. Wow. What a malarkey. So, now, John de Guisors was now the king's approved appointment for mayor. And the matter's solved, right? No. because Michael Tovey would become mayor again very soon, and Nicholas Batt would become sheriff again very soon, and the relations between King and London did not bode well for the future. Indeed, London records say later in that year, 1246, quote, Peter FitzAlan was made mayor, and in the same year, that is to say the Grace 1246 on the 20th day of February, there was an earthquake at London at the ninth hour, unquote. And this physical earthquake seemed to herald a political one. And generally, a feeling of ominous foreboding was clearly being felt by all at the time. Henry and London did not get on. London was clearly clashing with his cold winter king. Well, some of them were. The city does appear to have begun to develop political divisions. The political class was being torn between economic and realpolitik realities, and both sides were hoping to gather the citizens to support them. People saw nothing but trouble ahead. Indeed, in 1246, this sense of forebodance continued with a strange prophecy. Who made it? Well, quote, Master Walter Prewes, a clerk, who publicly declared that almost all the planets were then coming together under one sign of the zodiac, namely Capricorn, and would cause great commotion in the elements, and stir up heavy storms of wind, and foretold that a great destruction of animals. This prediction of his was not altogether void of truth, for on a sudden, St. Paul's Church was suddenly shaken by such a storm of wind that great fear seized on all. Extraordinary black clouds of tower-like form appeared in the western part of the heavens, and thunder began to roar, lightning to dart forth, and the wind to rise, and throughout the whole night and the following day, such a heavy storm of wind raged that was never remembered to have occurred before. And this storm continued for 15 days more without interruption. Oaks were torn up by the roots and fell, and houses, towers, and other buildings were thrown down or shaken so that the elements seemed to join in the perturbation of man, unquote. That was a whale of a storm. Something big and bad was coming. Something terrible was just below the surface, and there was nothing London could do to avoid it. This being said, the seeds of this needed something extraordinary to happen to fertilize them. And that extraordinary thing was just about to happen in 1247. That was the year Jesus came to Westminster. But I'll save that for the next part of the story. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back again next week for another chapter in the ongoing saga of the story of London. Cheers.